Our storyteller tonight is not a usual writer. In fact, she is a forensic scientist, and she spent 45 years in an increasingly important and massively transformed field of forensics. She's worked on cases such as the Yorkshire Ripper, one where a policeman said he was abducted by aliens, the murder of two-year-old Jamie Bulger by 2 10-year-olds, you'll remember that case, an investigation into whether the death of Lady Diana was a conspiracy. Her book is called When the Dogs Don't Bark, and her name is Dr. Angela Gallop, and she joins us due to the wonders of technology from the BBC in Oxford tonight. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. Now, a lot of people probably say this to you when you meet them at parties, but why on earth did you become a forensic scientist?
Yeah, I've often asked myself that question, actually, but I think it was because I was at university and I was writing up my thesis at the time and wondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life and thinking about continuing in academia because that's kind of the easiest thing to do, but really knowing that it wouldn't suit me. I mean, I'd had a great time. I had been researching into sea slugs, which are absolutely fascinating biochemically, but only about 6 people around the world cared what I found.
Yes.
And that wasn't quite big enough for me, so I wanted something that was more immediately helpful or important.
Mm. Well, it definitely is so, but humans don't behave as well as sea slugs, I imagine, and that's what you see.
Yeah, I guess so. But it was the idea of a friend of mine who came across the library with this ad and said, "Hey, Angela, I think this might suit you. You know, you've been whinging about not being too academic and here's this job." And so that's how I actually got into it. It's nothing to do with me or realising anything, you know.
Right.
It was him.
What do forensic scientists actually do, and how is that different to what we think that they do from the outside?
Well, I think that from the outside, there's a perception that there are sort of, you know, one or two multi-talented people, and there's particularly one show I'm thinking of in Britain, which I probably better not name, but that...
Oh, come on. You're in Australia. No one in Britain will hear you.
Anyway, well, you'll know which it is when I start talking about it.
Okay.
But this person is absolutely unbelievable because they're a pathologist, they're a forensic scientist, and there are loads of different sorts of forensic scientists. And that will help a bit. She is also a police investigator. She's
yes.
a family liaison officer.
Yeah.
She's loads of other things as well. So it's just, you know, almost impossible that anybody could do all of that. And instead of that, what the reality is that it's all about teamwork, because we all have our own individual specializations, and often, and particularly for the complicated cases, you need to have a range of expertise available to you, so you have to work as a team. So it's all about being really effective as a team, and it's also, I think, on the television it doesn't come over nearly as subtle as it actually is, because, you know, it's like micro excavations, you know, you're looking for something, you're looking for a way into a case. And then you're kind of, you know, you're looking, and if you find something, then you're likely to find something else. You've got to kind of dig it out. But you've got to be very careful because you mustn't lose it. You mustn't contaminate it. And so it's all these things. And it stretches right from the crime scene, where we go to help sometimes, especially in complex cases, right through everything you do in the laboratory, through to court, obviously, when you go and give evidence on it. So it's quite a broad range of activities you get involved in.
You're not necessarily running around with the police with guns, like it's often portrayed, but you do go to crime scenes.
Guns,
yes, because that's an important thing, isn't it, to actually see where the crime took place. And you have a moment in your book where someone says, oh, the forensic scientists just stand around. What are they doing when you first get there and you're standing around?
Desperately trying to work out what happened, so you know, work out what things you should take, where your forensic opportunities lie. And that's one of the most important things you do in the, you know, to begin with. Because, you know, obviously, if you miss those or if you wreck them in some way, then you're limiting what you can do afterwards. So it's really, really important to get crime scene investigation right. And I think over all my years in forensic science, I think I've come to realise that while, you know, people often think they understand the crime scene, they actually may not understand it in sufficient detail. So it is really, really important to get a grip of it in those first early times in an investigation, just to make sure you get the most out of it and you're most helpful to the police and then most helpful to the court at the end of the day.
And you can see things that others can't, like Sherlock Holmes, you know, where he goes, this happened and that happened, and you've got a part in your book where you're looking at blood splatters. You know where a woman went and how tall she was.
Yeah, I mean, you just use all the things that you know, and you learn to sort of fit them together, and you learn how to work out what happened. Sequence of events is incredibly important, and so you learn to do that. And sometimes, I mean, in that particular case, I was just sort of messing about with the police officer. Really, I said, you know, and I can tell you the victim was so, you know, this tall, and I think he was just rather surprised. But it was actually fairly basic what I'd done. But of course, if you don't know about it, then you don't realise. So it was all part of that understanding the crime scene that is so terribly critical.
Yeah, and. Now it's you worked back in the 70s and 80s before there was computers and cross referencing. So I imagine the field has changed so much with the developments of technology.
Yeah, absolutely, it has. It's just, you know, so very different. When I think of the first really big difficult cases we were doing, I worked in Yorkshire at the time, so we were heavily involved in the Yorkshire Ripper case in my laboratory. And when I think about the kind of techniques we had then, you know, where we had just blood grouping, which it gives you very little discrimination compared with DNA these days, and even, you know, even sort of databasing and all that sort of thing was so much more complicated than it is now. So it was just different. And we also did some extremely dangerous things, you know, in the laboratory. Our procedures and the chemicals we were using were horrific. I mean, we used to spray carcinogenic chemicals around with gay abandon.
Oh, gosh.
For our blood, for our sort of detecting some body fluids. And so that was not good. And I remember one of our blood grouping tests required us to weigh out this other chemical, which was also shown to be a nerve toxin. And so that was horrible. So, and we used to too, I mean, in the corner of the lab, and you know, a search lab, we would have a washing line up. This was in the early to mid 70s. We had this washing line, and we used to dry off heavily bloodstained clothing so that we could examine it dry, obviously. And it was just hanging there drying in the corner of the lab. Well, I mean, and we often didn't wear gloves, you know, let alone a hairnet and a mask and all the other stuff we wear today. So it was just a different world completely.
Mm. You're on Nightlife. I'm talking to Dr. Angela Gallop, who's a forensic scientist, and her book is called When Dogs Don't Bark, A Forensic Scientist's Search for the Truth. I mean, you must have to compartmentalise. You said you'd been to the crime scene of the Yorkshire Ripper. You go to many over the years in your career. You had these, you know, go and see blood splatters. There's bits of clothing up in your laboratory. As I said, humans, much more violent and awful than sea slugs, your previous specialty. Do you have to compartmentalise the work you're doing when you're trying to solve and help solve crimes?
I think mainly it's made much easier by the fact that actually you have to hurry up, because, you know, obviously there could be some really dangerous person out there. So, you know, you have to hurry up with what you do, but you have to be really, really careful you don't wreck anything. And I think, you know, and you get the best out of everything. And I think it's the determination to do that and the need to do that and the criticality of that. I think it just carries you through an awful lot of it, because, you know, you haven't got time to sit wilting in a corner. You know, worrying about man's inhumanity to man. You've just got to get on with it and do it to the best of your ability. So I think, you know, fortunately, that probably removes quite a lot of the stuff that if you were just witnessing it as someone at a crime scene, you know, who'd sort of seen the whole thing and would just, you know, just happen to be there, I think it makes it so much easier.
Because you're there to do a job. Yeah.
You're there to do a job, and you're not nervous when you're there because the danger's passed. You know, the danger's happened. I mean, the only time that I ever felt in a personal way, I suppose, for example, the Yorkshire Ripper, the danger of the Yorkshire Ripper was when I was driving home at night, you know, from the cities in the north of England where I used to operate. And I had a very old car at the time. I used to be very relieved. I mean, I was driving through a rather dark part of Leeds. I'd be very pleased to get out into the open countryside and think, right, well, I'm probably out of Ripper territory now.
You don't want your car breaking down. You know? Yeah, well, you know too much. Yeah. And you see such a warped view of society because you are seeing the worst of the worst.
So yeah, you do. Yeah, I remember when I first started wondering if everybody, or if there was anybody else in the world who washed their clothing regularly. I do remember thinking that, like, it can't just be me, you know, and maybe one or two of my colleagues. But of course, you get a sense of balance. You get that absolutely as you do more of it. You realise you're just overreacting. But there are, you know, there are times early on, particularly when, you know, you do just wonder. But but never enough to, not enough to really put you off. I mean, I think the first case I ever helped with, so I'd only been in the lab for, very few days, when I had the first thing to examine myself. It was like a professional apprenticeship in those days, and still is actually these days to a large extent. But I was given this handbag to examine. It was my very first item on my own, and it was made of vinyl plastic. And it was a very warm day in the lab, so you could smell this vinyl, smell the plastic of it. And then inside, there was this rotting apple, and there was a lot of blood staining on the outside of the bag. And the combination of those smells was dreadful. And that was another moment when I thought, you know, my God, I went home that night and thought, is this really the job for me?
Right.
You know,
but that wasn't even a murder.
Was way on a course.
Right, but you were just trying to work out who owned it, weren't you?
Yeah, no, it was a murder. It was a man who'd tried to exorcise his wife and and her pet, you know, because he thought they were possessed of evil spirits.
Right, okay. There was another handbag one in your book. Yeah, no, terrible, yeah. Terrible. I mean, DNA profiling has utterly transformed forensics has it meant that crimes now that you couldn't have solved in the past, you can? Because you do talk about cold cases you've worked on as well.
Absolutely. I think it was one of the key advances that enabled us to start doing quite so many or being so successful with older cases. But I think that the thing is that it's incredibly powerful. You know, it produces these enormous statistics. But at the same time, and kind of associated with that, you have to be incredibly careful about it because, you know, you have to, and because we can look at such tiny amounts of material, you know, you don't even need to be able to see anything to get a DNA profile out of it. So it means you have to be really, really careful that you know what it is has given you the DNA profile. And there's no alternative innocent or legitimate explanation for it. And so in a way it helps, in another way it makes interpretation much more difficult. And so you have to be really, really careful with things like DNA.
So it's a bit of a double-edged sword in a way.
It is.
And the context is everything, you say, when you're working out.
Absolutely. And I think that's something, you know, people tend to think that forensic science is black and white. You do a test, you get a result, and Bob's your uncle. But actually, you can do a test and get a result, but then it's what the result means in the context of that particular case, which is kind of what I've been saying about DNA, but it applies to all kinds of evidence in a case. Whatever you get, you have to be careful that it couldn't just be, you know, prior contact between a victim and a suspect, or the suspect's been at the crime scene beforehand, or been in contact with something from the crime scene beforehand, perfectly legitimately. Mm. You have to be really careful, or there's not some transfer route by which the traces that you found could have got onto them, you know, without them doing anything.
I wonder what you think about all these amateur podcasts now, that true crime podcasts, which are massive, and they always have one episode that says we've found a bit more DNA, you know, that was 50 years ago and denatured, and if only we could send this off, that we could solve this entire murder. Do we expect too much out of it?
Yeah, I'm sure. But, I mean, on the other hand, you know, you're likely to be able to get DNA results, as long as, you know, the samples aren't too denatured or too, you know, too awful. You're likely to be able to get a result, but it's what it means. Mm. And just because you get a DNA profile result does not mean that someone's guilty. And I think, I mean, I've been writing about this for a long time because I was very nervous, you know, right from the start, really. You know, DNA gives you big statistics, which means that someone's guilty. You had to be really, really careful not to do that, you know, because it might not.
Yeah. And so you were asked to investigate the conspiracy theories about Lady Diana, who died in the tunnel in Paris. So what were the conspiracy theories at the time? The thought was that she was pregnant and the driver wasn't really drunk. And was there was a commission of inquiry, was it, where they asked you to go back and test the evidence?
Yes. Sir John Stevens, now Lord Stevens, he was a commissioner, originally commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, and he was invited to conduct a really thorough investigation, a once and for all type investigation into this case, because there was so much concern about it that there was some conspiracy, some cover up at some very high level in the British establishment. And so he conducted a really, really thorough investigation. And we were just a part of that.
Right.
And there were three things we were asked to help with. One of them was to help with whether or not Diana might have been pregnant, because that might have been part of the motive if she had been. And so that was very important. And so we did a small piece of work in connection with Professor David Cowan at King's. We were looking at, you know, whether or not we could get samples for a test that he'd been developing for pregnancy and also for things that you take to avoid pregnancy.
Contraceptive pill. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we helped with getting a sample, a sort of decent sample, because one of the problems was that from a forensic point of view, obviously, only was that Diana had blood transfusions, and so it was important to get a sample of her blood pre-transfusion. So we helped with that.
Right.
And also there was some concern about whether or not Henri Paul's blood sample really had come from him. It was the one that showed that he had quite a lot of alcohol in his blood.
Mm.
And so we did some DNA profiling on the blood sample and showed that that it had come from him, and so there was no
right. She was not pregnant, and he indeed had been drinking.
He had indeed been drinking, and then the last thing we did was to have a look at some traces left on the Mercedes that Diana had been travelling in, because there was some suggestion that there'd been collision with a particular Fiat Uno car. So we were having a look at some of that sort of stuff.
And in terms of a profession to be going into now, is it becoming increasingly specialised? As a job, do you not, or do you still get to kind of see a case in its complexity?
Well, somebody needs to do that. You know, if you're going to be able to pull everything together, well, first of all, design elegant investigation strategies, somebody needs to know. So some scientists need to be trained broadly to be able to do that. So to know the sort of types of techniques that you can deploy. And then, you know, make sure the right things are done, and then pull all the evidence together at the end of the day and talk about, in general terms, what it means. So it is in that sense. But in another sense, because we are discovering so much more about so much more, you know, we are becoming more specialised.
Mm.
And we've got these new areas. We've got DNA profiling, absolutely, but we've got the whole digital forensics area, you know, because now we live our lives so differently. We're all on our digital devices all the time.
Yeah.
And of course, they store massive amounts of information about us and what we've been doing, which of course is critically important.
Yes, you can know where somebody is and where they were on the time, even if they say
That's
they were
right.
somewhere else.
It's, you can do, yeah.
It's sort of as much of a revolution as the DNA encoding, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it's keeping up with that and being able to download stuff quickly enough. You know, and enough of this information, and we've seen here in the UK, I'm not sure about Australia, but we've seen some cases fail because not a thorough enough job was done on extracting information and analysing it and working out what it really meant in the context of the case. It's just like any other kind of evidence.
Right. Okay.
So,
well,
so it's complicated.
It is. It's not as simple as we think. Do you like any of the forensic shows, CSI or Bones or any of the shows you see? Do you enjoy them for a laugh as a real forensic scientist about you know, how they portray your life?
No, I don't. But I'm very happy for everybody else. I'm very happy they make good television. And I think people should have them and watch them and enjoy them. And just because I'm so grouchy in the corner, you know, is nothing to do with me. I think they're fine. They've got a place.
I always watch people on the radio and think you get far more breaks when songs are on than we do. We don't get that long. We're not running around like that having long chats. Yeah. All right. Fantastic. Well, thank you for talking to me tonight about your life and your work and your book.
No, not at all. Thank you very much.
Great to have you. Isn't that amazing? From Oxford, Dr. Angela Gallup, When the Dogs Don't Bark, A Forensic Scientist's Search for the Truth is the name of the book.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Sarah McDonald.